You're listening to the John DePietro Show. Providence Mayor Brett Smiley was on Community Focus. It's a nice segment they do on WPRI in the afternoon. Kim Kalunian has turned that into a very valuable platform. People come in live to the studio, and he was asked, I believe, about the situation with the bridge, and then also with this Foxy Village that's going to be going on, where they're going to start this, the state is adopting some adults who are going to live behind the Foxy Lady. Let's join and tune into this.
The DOT says this new traffic pattern that they enacted late Friday that moves the lane shifts further east on the westbound side to try and alleviate some traffic. They say it appears to be easing congestion in the cities and the neighborhoods around the bridge, and they're going to decide whether to keep this in place. Is it working in your opinion?
It doesn't hugely affect Providence, so I don't have a strong opinion on that. I think the potential benefit is all of the people who are trying to get on ramps in East Providence to have that merge lane be available to them to free up some of the traffic in East Providence. By the time, if you're coming into Providence, particularly in the morning rush hour, by the time you've made it to the bridge, you're kind of home free at that point. And so it hasn't had a huge impact on Providence itself. I leave it to the mayor of East Providence, who it continues to bear the brunt of this crisis, to decide if it's an advantage for his residents, for whom I have a great deal of empathy. I've met plenty of people in East Providence who say they can't even back out of their own driveway. Yeah. That's terrible. That's really sort of not my decision to make on this modification.
Let's talk about, you were at the press conference Monday where the head of the Federal Highway Administration says if this bridge needs to be replaced, it could take 1 to 2 years. Yeah. In your opinion, is the current situation, the traffic, the setup, is that sustainable for the next 1 or 2 years?
I think if we knew that this was going to be, and it's an if, we don't know this yet, if we knew this was going to be a replacement and it's going to be 2 years, then I know at least from my perspective, from Providence's perspective, we're going to take a hard look at some more permanent changes. We went into this with temporary changes thinking it was 3 months. I mean, for example, there's a part of the detour route, there's a left turn that trucks have to make that's an intersection that's not big enough for trucks. And so we had to move the line that you stop at the red light back. Right now, that's got a cone and a temporary signage. We might look at some more permanent infrastructure changes to say, okay, we have to prepare for this. We also need to think about Providence Police are doing a lot of traffic details. They've really helped. But in most cases, we're ordering those men and women to stay after and do that traffic detail. And these are, you know, hardworking men and women in the Providence Police Department who aren't making it home for dinner, who aren't making it home for a kid's birthday party. If this is a two-year thing, I'm going to need a different staffing plan. And so there's some longer-term things that we would do if this were going to be semi-permanent, you know, 2 or 3 years. And that's the planning that we're starting internally. I imagine the mayor of East Providence is doing the same, and I would think DOT is thinking about these things as well.
All right, I want to shift gears a little bit. There are some new so-called pallet shelters that have been built sort of in the area of the Foxy Lady. Has the city received any complaints about them, and when are they going to be up and running for people to seek shelter in?
Yeah, so we certainly got a lot of questions. There aren't really abutting residential neighbors, right? So there's some businesses there. We've tried to answer all of their questions. Maybe there's a little bit of anxiety, but I wouldn't classify them as complaints.
Okay.
And we're planning on an occupancy around March. They're doing the site prep right now. They've laid a sewer line, water line. There's some infrastructure that has to happen to facilitate this. But we're planning on a March opening. We're trying to answer all the residents' concerns. And as I've said before, I think this is worth trying. It's certainly better than an encampment. I don't aspire for any of my residents, and I don't think we as a community should aspire that this be where people live. But it's better than living on the streets, and it might keep people alive until we can get them into better, more permanent housing.
We've got less than a minute left, but on the topic of housing, you just announced this newly created City Office of Housing and Human Services. Why did you feel the city needed its own department to sort of oversee this issue?
Yeah, so we've really brought two departments together. Mm-hmm. So there's some efficiency here. This is not growing the bureaucracy. This is, in fact, actually reducing a position and allowing us to better coordinate. over time, we have more and more gotten involved in providing social services. All the conversation around the unhoused, certainly the opioid crisis, food insecurity, many of these programs which grew through the pandemic, which are vital to providing services to our residents, you know, they had kind of grown out of where they were, and they weren't being as well coordinated as they should have been. And so we've brought these departments together. There's a ton of overlap in the work that they do. We think we'll deliver more services better for less money under this new structure.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Providence Mayor Brett Smiley, thanks for being here before.
Thank you.
You know, notice he's very, very strict, very straightforward, the mayor of Providence. Got a lot going on. Not easy trying to juggle some of these problems with the state. I like he also recognized it's East Providence that is really bearing the brunt of this, and the traffic is just unrelenting. It's what's playing out right now is the McKee people, they just don't have a plan. I'm not even convinced that there could be a plan. I'm not convinced that there's any viable option that makes sense. And the hard part about this is I don't know where this is going to go. I don't think they know where this is going to go. There's certainly no magic bullet coming here. But that is, Mayor Providence certainly seems to be handling and focusing on quality of life issues. The only thing I'll say about the pallet shelters, Foxy Village, is traditionally, if you look at a California and the West Coast places where they've tried this, it's not temporary. It becomes permanent. The people just say, great, I'll just live here. Granted, they're not on the street. Taxpayers have to pay for it. Seems like an awful lot of money to have to pay for where these people are going to live. But it's my understanding. Okay, so they're not in a tent, but it's still almost the equivalent of an encampment. I think they're going to have a lot of problems with it. And then they're going to put some more up. And I don't in any way see this as a solution. I don't think it should be tolerated. Like I said, you look at the West Coast, and it just becomes a permanent form of housing. You're listening to The John DePietro Show. Supreme Court, consider a historic challenge. President Trump's ability to seek the Republican presidential nomination. They have to do the right thing and allow him to be on the ballot. Let's hear the latest.
Case, the biggest elections case since Bush versus Gore back in 2000. The question, should Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election, including his participation in the attack on the Capitol, his incitement of that attack on January 6th, keep him off the 2024 presidential ballot? And this all comes down to one clause in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution passed right after the Civil War, which holds that no person who has previously taken an oath to support the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection can hold public office afterwards. The Colorado Supreme Court, in a case brought by six voters there, took a look at that clause and ruled that Trump must be removed from the ballot in that state. In Maine, the Secretary of State did the same thing, and other states are considering it too, while still other states have rejected the idea. So in court, Trump's lawyers will argue that he did not engage in insurrection, that the language of the amendment does not apply to presidents, and that Congress must first pass a law spelling out how to enforce that clause. Colorado's lawyers, they'll argue that the amendment means what the amendment says, that Trump did engage in insurrection and that he must be banned from holding public office. And there's one thing that all the parties here today agree on. This is a case of national importance that only the Supreme Court can and must resolve in this election year. George.
Terry Moran, thanks. Let's get more from our chief Washington correspondent, John Carl. Terry brought up the Bush v. Gore case, which decided the 2000 election. In some ways, this is far more consequential than that.
This is a huge moment for the Supreme Court. It is a huge moment for the country. And look, George, this Supreme Court is a conservative court, three Trump justices. It's a court that's been mired in some controversy. But while it is a conservative court, this has not been a Trump court. In fact, this court has repeatedly ruled against Donald Trump or shown independence from him. Think about it. Trump expected his justices, as he considered his justices, to help him overturn the election results. They rejected the effort to do that in that Texas case in December of 2020. The January 6th committee wanted his White House records. Trump went all the way to the Supreme Court to try to block them from getting. The Supreme Court ruled for the January 6th committee. They even ruled prior to that to allow Congress to get his tax records. So the court has shown real independence from Trump. You know, looking at this, let's hope this decision is not one that breaks down on party lines.
No question what you're saying is true, but this is also a court that is just not going to be eager to appear to decide the 2024 election.
I mean, absolutely not. And think about how long we saw the repercussions from the Bush v. Gore case, which was so controversial and made the court seen as so much more of a partisan body. And John Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, has clearly made it clear that he wants the court to be not seen as yet another political institution. He talks about how, you know, there aren't Trump justices or Bush justices or Obama justices. There are, you know, judges of the law. So, yes, he is not going to want to get mired in this. But this is not the only one. I mean, Trump's going to try to go to the Supreme Court almost certainly. He said he's going to appeal. The question of whether or not he has absolute immunity. So you could have two cases central to this election, absolutely central to this election, decided by this Supreme
Court. We'll see if they can come up with some kind of balancing there, John.
I mean, two unanimous decisions would be nice.
I cannot see a scenario where they're going to keep him. I mean, they can't. It shouldn't even be there in the first place. So I also want to. There's this bizarre story. Two American women say they were drugged and assaulted in the Bahamas while they were on vacation. And a lot of people are traveling this over the next couple of weeks. Listen to this story.
FBI now investigating.
Wow.
Amber Shearer and Dangalia Dobson were on their first kids-free vacation on board a Carnival cruise.
We've been best friends for over 20 years, and we decided we were going to make this our girls' trip.
On the last day of their trip, they stopped at a local resort on Grand Bahama Island, a resort they say the cruise ship recommended. Once there, the mothers claimed they were offered a two-for-one drink, which they accepted, but immediately fell ill.
After the first drink, we had to get out of the ocean because we noticed that it was just hitting so hard. I just felt so out of it.
Shearer and Dobson say they lost consciousness and allege that after drinking the drugged cocktails, members of the resort staff sexually assaulted them.
I vaguely remember glimpses of his face. I don't remember all of it. I don't remember everything. But I remembered enough of that he was a staff worker and he had a goatee and he was a local. But the resort security were able to go pull the footage and identify them right then and there.
They say there were bruises on their legs and that they tested positive for various drugs. The Royal Bahamas police posting on Facebook confirming two men were arrested for sexual assault of two women and that an investigation is underway. Shearer and Dobson say that's not enough. They're back in the U.S. demanding justice. The State Department issued a level 2 travel advisory for the Bahamas in late January due to an increase in homicides and sexual violence.
It's extremely important if you're going to go overseas to look on the State Department website as to what they say about crime. What security level is it?
An attorney for the women says the cruise ship bears some responsibility.
Carnival has an obligation to warn about dangerous conditions that they know about or they should know about. And they also have an obligation to make sure that the areas that they're recommending to passengers, to tourists, are safe.
Carnival crews responding to the incident saying in a statement, while ashore in Freeport, Bahamas on an independent shore excursion, two guests on Carnival Elation reported to Bahamian police that they were sexually assaulted at a local beach. Our onboard care team provided support for the two guests as they sailed back to Jacksonville. Bahamian police are investigating the matter and Carnival is providing our full cooperation.
So what can you do?
You know, you got to be very, very cautious in those situations. And let's see what, if justice can prevail. Folks, you're listening to the John DePietro Show. You're listening to the John DePietro Show. So controversy in Cranston, where now you have some activists. They're upset because of what's happening, where you had a Hispanic individual who approached Friday morning, approached a 14-year-old girl who was going to Cranston East and he tried to speak Spanish to her. And she said, I think he said to her something like, "You have a nice body." And then she said, "Excuse me? Like, I'm only 14. He said, "That's okay." And he grabbed her arm. Now, she pulled away, and it's described as a Hispanic man speaking Spanish, and then they have his picture. Well, now some activists are upset over the fact that, number one, it was described as a man under the guise of you don't know what the gender is, meaning how that person identifies. And number two, they don't like the fact that he was identified as Hispanic. So I did a TikTok video on this, and I would play it quickly.
Breaking news out of Cranston, Rhode Island. 14-year-old girl grabbed by the arm as she was walking to school. There's the suspect, described Hispanic man, speaking Spanish to her. She's trying to make conversation, tell her she had a nice body. She said, "Excuse me, I'm 14 years old." He said, "That's okay." He tried to grab her by the arm. She broke away, told a crossing guard, and now police are searching for the suspect. Now, here's the controversy that is breaking out. Activists are upset because the description went out saying Hispanic man speaking Spanish. They would prefer that it should not say Hispanic or even man. What do you think? I think when a crime is committed, and again, why would that suspect grab a 14-year-old girl walking to high school by the arm and then trying to, who knows what was going to happen, most likely a migrant? What do you think? Don't you think the most descriptive description of a suspect should go out, whether it's white or black, Hispanic, whatever it may be? Controversy in Cranston. Manhunt is on for the suspect. A 14-year-old girl grabbed as she was just walking to high school. Cranston police are on the case. We'll be following it on the scene live stream.
You know, I find it, I'm not surprised by this. This has become the new way. Sometimes the media goes along with it. Most times, hopefully, that they do not. But it is kind of like the new way that they feel they might be offending someone if they put how they're described. If there's a bank robbery and or any type of robbery, if it happens to be a person of color, there's a lot of activists now, they don't want the description to go out that it was person of color. In the past, they were saying you should just say it was a man that stole it. And many times, as I've pointed out of recent years, that a lot of times the media will go along with it. Not all the time. Now, because of the political correctness with the gender crowd, now they don't even like that if a gender is assigned, meaning in this case, Hispanic male. So I think it's, you know, I think it's foolishness. When a crime or suspected crime is committed, whatever the depiction, description of that individual is, if it's a white male, then the description should be it was a white male. If it's an Asian female, then it's an Asian female. If it's someone who is Hispanic, speaking Spanish, part of the description should be that it happened to be a male and speaking Spanish. Now, if in fact they catch this person and the person says, "Well, I don't identify as a man," well, that really has no bearing on the case. It's really just the depiction. To me, this is almost the equivalent of someone trying to argue that, the suspect was described wearing a red jacket when it was actually maroon or pink or what have you. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is they have photos of the suspect. It was a 14-year-old girl, and her description was that he was speaking or trying to speak Spanish to her, and then this happened. So I find it ridiculous. I think the most important factor here is that they find the perpetrator, not so much trying to placate many of these activists. Folks, you're listening to the John DePietro Show. It's time for our legal segment. Joining us right now, he is our legal expert, one of Rhode Island's top attorneys. It is attorney Tim Dodd. And Tim, why don't we start off with something that is kind of puzzling to some, and the media pointing out to it could be completely above board. But the revelation that the Rhode Island DOT was requiring employees connected to the Washington Bridge to sign non-disclosure agreements. Just non-disclosure agreements, NDAs, whenever they come up, certainly garner a lot of attention. So if you could walk us through a little bit.
Well, yeah, it's a headline that doesn't have a lot of backup to it, to my understanding. What I understand is that the NDAs were required when the DOD was negotiating for one of the largest or most significant contracts relating to work needed on the bridge. Now, I guess the NDA would prohibit employees from giving information that they were aware of to any of the potential bidders for the contract work on the bridge. I think the headline makes it seem, and I could be wrong, but I don't think so, that this NDA has something to do with the newly discovered failures of the bridge and what's going to have to happen. It seems to me that an NDA is a very provocative thing for the department to require. I'm not sure if, I think most of the DOT workers are unionized in some form or fashion. Again, I could be wrong, but I don't think so. I wonder if there were any complaints made about the necessity of signing an NDA. And what's the scope of it? What does it cover? What can an employee talk about? What are they barred from talking about? Who are they barred from speaking to? There's so many details that go into it, but the very existence of an NDA is, with all of the secrecy and inability to answer questions about the future of this bridge and what's going to be needed to fix it and how long is it going to take, the existence of this non-disclosure agreement situation, the bad optics just continue for this whole bridge, what appears to be a fiasco. Can they speak to federal investigators? I believe the NDA is specific to bidders on contract work. Now, why would an NDA be required? If it's an NDA to prevent workers from giving inside information about the contract, the scope of the contract, which could influence the bids, or if certain employees might know what other competitors are bidding and they're prohibited from letting others know what the bids are that are coming in. I mean, we really need to see the NDA to see what the scope of it is, and I don't believe that's been released yet.
And Tim, if someone signed one and then they were called, let's just say, again, hypothetical, but called in front of prosecutors, could they use that as a defense to not answer questions?
Well, I think that would be a legitimate issue to be brought up. It might require a judge to give the person from whom information is, let's assume somebody's calling before a grand jury and they say, well, I can't talk about it because I signed this NDA. Typically something like that would go before a court for a determination as to whether or not that NDA was enforceable and whether or not the person could be given immunity from the language contained in the NDA. And we don't really know the scope of this NDA, what it prevents employees from talking about. Did everyone have to sign it? Or did only like supervisors have to sign it? Did only people who were involved in the contract negotiation process have to sign it? This is so much we have to know. And I don't think we've got all the information available. But again, it's just the optics are terrible that they've got people signing NDAs. It doesn't look good at all.
And Tim, what about the fact that it is, you know, the feds are investigating this? When there was a press availability the other day, there was speculation that the director of the DOT was no longer going to be answering questions from the press. Now, since there is a federal inquiry, and right now they haven't been subpoenaed, but they are turning over documents, what would be normally the advice on some of the people that were involved with the closure of the bridge, what led to that. Is that something that maybe they should stop talking about publicly?
Which category of employees are you talking about? Are you talking about Peter Alviti or
yes.
anyone in the chain of command?
Yeah, let's say Peter Alviti.
Well, Peter Alviti is the director. If the governor says you're not going to be taking questions anymore, we're going to turn it over to his deputy chief of staff, the governor from the governor's office, well, that's the governor's call. He ultimately oversees all of his department directors. If Peter Alviti or any of the other senior people at DOT were of the opinion that they might have some exposure, either civilly or criminally, and I don't have any reason to believe either of those is true at this point.
Yep.
But if the individual DOT employee has some reason to believe that they might have exposure criminally or civilly, they should not be speaking to the press. They should not be answering questions. And most importantly, they should lawyer up so they have some sounding board for what they should and shouldn't say, or if they do have any exposure for any type of lawsuit, criminal or civil. You got to lawyer up.
Folks, quick break. Much more ahead. Our legal expert, attorney Tim Dodd, right here on the John DePietro Show. We speak with our legal expert. It's attorney Tim Dodd. Well, Tim, obviously each week we've been discussing President Trump. This is no exception. Federal appeals court found Donald Trump not entitled broad immunity from federal prosecutors. Let's walk through that.
This is one step in a long process, which, as we've discussed, will ultimately get to the United States Supreme Court. This was a decision of a federal appeals court, not the full court, but this was on an emergency petition. Two of the judges, my understanding, were Joe Biden appointees. One of the judges was Bush 41 appointee, and the three judges who heard the matter were all not in favor of or not persuaded by the Trump argument that a president once out of office should still be granted immunity from prosecution for acts taken while in office. You know, Trump's got a very difficult position here because his lawyers are typically asked in these scenarios, so are you saying that the president could injure some, could shoot somebody, could kill somebody, or order somebody from within his administration to go kill a political opponent? Would the president, once out of office, be immune from being prosecuted for that type of criminal activity? Trump's people are almost compelled to say, yeah, but it's a difficult argument to make. There are certain things that a president might do while in office, decisions made that a president cannot be prosecuted for while in office. But once out of office, a president could be so prosecuted. And that's exactly what the Department of Justice in some of the various states are attempting to do, to go after Trump both civilly and, most importantly, criminally, for conduct and decisions and acts taken while he was president. Remember, on January 6th, when the incident at the Capitol occurred, he was still president. So he's suggesting that whatever he did or didn't do on that day should be something he cannot be prosecuted for once out of office. The president's position is that if civil and criminal actions are allowed to be taken against a president once he or she is an ex-president and no longer the president, but now just a private citizen once again, that will hamstring a president because a president, when making a decision, will always be looking over his or her shoulder to make sure that the actions taken could not subject the president, once out of office, to these types of civil or criminal cases. So Trump's got a point, but his point sort of falls apart because his counsel are suggesting that there's a blanket immunity from any sort of civil or criminal prosecution for an ex-president. So I guess when Joe Biden's out of office, someone or some department, or depending on what administration might be in charge, might say that Biden's failure to secure the border was in direct violation of federal law and could be sued either criminally or civilly for his failure to do anything to stop that from happening. It could be as simple as the type of executive orders that Donald Trump used when he was newly in office. There's any number of things a president might do. I think the Trump lawyer suggested, well, could President Obama, now a private citizen, be sued civilly or charges brought criminally, if the statute of limitations would allow, for killing civilians during certain drone strikes overseas? I mean, you can get into some very far-fetched scenarios. You know, it's just like this three-member panel said, well, can the president kill somebody and be immune from prosecution? The trick there becomes, if the president kills somebody while in office, shoots somebody, Trump's lawyers now say, well, if the president takes such actions while in office, then he can be impeached and convicted by the Senate and removed from office. But that's not a criminal prosecution. That's simply removal from office.
Sure.
And it goes back and forth, because during Trump's second impeachment hearing, his lawyers were saying at the time, you can't impeach me because I'm out of office. Because if you recall, the second impeachment happened after he was already out of office. But yep. The House decided, well, we're going to go after him anyways. So, like any good lawyer, Trump's lawyers are arguing both sides of the position when it's convenient for them to do so. This now goes, I believe, to the full circuit court. And if there's still a negative ruling thereafter, it would ultimately make its way to the Supreme Court. I think the Trump team will ultimately lose this one, because there's no easy way to make a demarcation as to what types of actions a president might take while in office, which might be criminal, that could be prosecuted once he or she is no longer in office, versus which you could not be prosecuted for. I don't see where a line can be drawn. Do I think it could cause real problems for ex-presidents down the line, as Trump is suggesting? I do. Nothing like this has ever happened before. I think the only times that it has happened, for instance, when Richard Nixon resigned, I guess he could have been prosecuted criminally for right. the actions that he took, except for the fact that President Ford pardoned him. I guess that Bill Clinton could have been prosecuted for the perjury that he engaged in during the his deposition. However, he cut a deal and paid a fine and agreed to a temporary suspension of his license to practice law. But if Clinton had made a deal, a compromise of his situation, he would have been prosecutable. And I guess he would have been saying, well, you can't prosecute me as a private citizen for actions I took while president. It would be the same arguments. At the end of the day, although there is a point to what President Trump is saying, because it could be a treacherous thing for ex-presidents and it could influence what we do while in office, Well, I think he still loses. And at the end of the day, I guess if you're the president, you should be thinking about, am I doing something which could be criminal? Am I doing something that I could be prosecuted for once I'm out of office?
Sure.
That should be a legitimate concern. Yep. So although Trump's buying time and delaying these trials, and he does have at least a colorable argument to be made, I think at the end of the day, he loses.
Folks, quick
even
break.
Even in the Supreme Court, he loses.
Much more with legal analyst attorney Tim Dodd right here on The John DePietro Show. You're listening to The John DePietro Show. Folks, how about this story? Jennifer Crumbley found guilty connection, her son's school shooting, the mother in Michigan. This is a groundbreaking case. You know, I'm applauding this. Let's hear the story from NBC.
Alex, good morning to you. We're not mentioning your last name for your own privacy reasons. I have to say, to have you here, it's a privilege, because what we ask jurors to do in this country is really, really difficult. To sit in judgment of their fellow citizen, and that is something that you and your fellow jurors did. What was it like in that courtroom, having that responsibility and delivering that verdict
yesterday?
Wow, she
was on the jury.
There was definitely a weight. I think any time we entered the courtroom, there was an undeniable weight on us. We all took the responsibility that was put upon us seriously, and I'm just one of 12 that made a very difficult decision.
What was the evidence that swayed you in the end? You said it wasn't an easy decision. This wasn't a slam dunk.
Not easy at all. So speaking for myself, I know that each individual juror had their own opinion. This did this for one person. This convinced the other. For me, I just feel like Jennifer didn't separate her son from the gun enough to save those lives that day.
You felt she was the last person known to have had custody of the gun.
Yes.
And then somehow it ends up in his hands.
And I think the responsibility of securing the weapon then falls on her.
What about those text messages or journal entries or things that the jurors saw where it indicated that Ethan had asked for help and that his parents hadn't given him that help? Was that persuasive to you?
To me personally, it wasn't as impactful as the evidence of her having the gun. But I know for my fellow jurors that the notebook played a huge part. Mm.
Tell me about her testimony. It's Jennifer Crumbley took the stand in her own defense. She testified. What did you make of her on the witness stand?
At the time, I tried to take her as she gave herself. But once we went into deliberation, it became clear that she wasn't a super reliable witness in this case.
Do you think she helped herself on the stand or hurt herself? Would it have been better, in other words, if she hadn't testified at all?
We'll never know.
Yeah. You talked about her testimony. There was a point where she was asked, would you have done anything differently? And she said she wouldn't have. How did that strike you and the other jurors?
It was repeated a lot in the deliberation room. I think that it was very upsetting to hear. I think that there are many small things that could have been done to prevent this.
When you went back into the jury room, you're the jury foreperson.
I am.
Which is a big responsibility. And I should just mention again, there is no manual for jurors. Nobody tells jurors how to deliberate.
Mm-mm.
So how did you handle it? And how was the jury immediately in agreement? Or how did it play out?
So I took it more as a job of facilitation. I wanted to make sure that each and every juror, to the best of my ability, was heard and understood and made their point, and we heard their piece. And so that was the role that I took on as the foreperson. It was not immediately unanimous, and it was my responsibility to hear the concerns of those on either side and construct an argument either way.
Do you feel that the jurors wish they could have heard from Ethan Crumbley himself?
I'm not sure how much that would have helped or hurt.
All right, Alex, thank you so much for your civil service. Being a juror is not easy, and this was a very difficult case. Thank you.
You know what's interesting about that is, so they're at school, and the kid's got the gun in the backpack. The mother didn't even say on the stand, well, in hindsight, we should have brought him home. In hindsight, we should have looked through his backpack. She took him to gun range before that. The father got him the gun 4 days before. The kid was clearly disturbed. I think this is a breakthrough case where the parents, whenever these things happen, people say, where were the parents? And now we know where the parents were. I don't think it's a bad thing that they're being held accountable in this situation. I actually think it's a good thing. Now, another story, it's so disturbing. I can't believe that the Mayorkas impeachment, that failed after all of that. And the Republicans have no one to blame but themselves. Listen to the story. This is so disappointing.
Killed a border deal they helped negotiate, failed to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary, and couldn't even get enough votes to pass additional aid to Israel. Overnight, an embarrassing defeat for Republicans. The House failing to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over his handling of the border.
On this vote, the yeas are 214 and the nays are 216. The resolution is not adopted.
A handful of GOP lawmakers refusing to fall in line, saying the party provided no evidence of an impeachable offense.
This is not a high crime or misdemeanor. This is a policy difference.
And that sets a very bad precedent that'll come back and bite Republican administrations in the future if we allow it to be said.
Republicans thought they had the votes, but then Texas Democrat Al Green, who just underwent emergency surgery, showed up, wheelchair-bound and in hospital scrubs, to cast the deciding vote. And moments later, a second setback for Speaker Mike Johnson. His bill to provide aid to Israel, also rejected. Johnson ducking out of the chamber. All of it capping off a chaotic 24 hours on Capitol Hill, with Republicans also backing away from a bipartisan border deal their own party helped negotiate.
I mean, it's actually our side that wanted to tackle the border issue. We started it.
That deal would have also provided aid to Israel and Ukraine. With $20 billion in border security, the most sweeping reform in decades.
We all see that there's a problem. Let's all agree that we need to do something.
It's the kind of package Johnson said he wanted for months.
You said a few months ago that you wanted to see a bipartisan agreement on border security and additional aid to Ukraine. Senator said that they did that.
They did not send us a border security measure. They didn't.
After Donald Trump started bashing the compromise, Johnson declared it dead on arrival.
It's time for Republicans in the Congress to show a little courage, to show a little spine, to make it clear to the American people that you work for them, not for anyone else.
So as for where things stand this morning, Senate Democrats will force two votes, one on that package, which is expected to fail, another one with just additional aid to both Israel and Ukraine. House Speaker Mike Johnson is vowing to hold another vote to try to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary in the coming days. And as for Trump, well, he is celebrating the news that border deal is dead. Of course, he wants to run on immigration in November, Robin.
And Rachel, we know that Trump is still the clear front runner in the Republican primary.
Clear frontrunner, and Nikki Haley decided to compete in the Nevada Republican primary. Donald Trump was not even on the ballot, and she still lost, with most voters deciding not to go with a candidate at all. Of course, the major contest for delegates is tomorrow for the caucuses, where Trump is the only candidate competing in that contest. And this morning, we are learning about a major shakeup within the RNC. Sources tell us that the chair, Ronna McDaniel, is expected to resign after the South Carolina primary. We were told this is a decision that she has discussed directly with Donald Trump, Robin.
All right.
Folks, you're listening to The John DePietro Show. AJ, drywall, plaster, home improvement, call them today for a free quote. You can also find them on Facebook, 401-323-9252. 323-9252. AJ, drywall, plasters, home improvement, frame to finish basements. What a difference it'll make in your basement. Acoustic ceilings. Look how beautiful your ceiling could be. New homes, additions. Also, commercial rehabs, painting, remodeling. Contact them today. It's a family-run business. AJ, drywall, plaster, home improvements. Call for a free quote. What a difference they'll make in your home, your ceilings, floors, basements, 401-323-9252. What a difference, beautiful walls and ceilings, 401-323-9252. You can also find them on Facebook. It's AJ Drywall, Plaster, and Home Improvements for your home or business. your oil needs. Make it Henry Oil. Call Henry Oil today, 401-521-0200. Reliable, affordable fuel oil delivery. Call Henry Oil today. Fuel oil, diesel, gasoline delivery. It's Henry Oil, residential, commercial, fuel oil delivery since 1947. They also have budget plans, service contracts, lock and cap pricing. You can depend on Henry Oil. Call them today, 401-521-0200. Serving most of Rhode Island and southeastern Mass. We got a long way to go with winter. Make sure that tank is filled. Call Henry Oil today. 401-521-0200. Henry Oil, a local family-run business since 1947 that you can depend on. For all your oil needs, call Henry Oil today. 401-521-0200. Propane Plus, call them today. Heating and cooling in Rhode Island, 401-885-4209. In Massachusetts, 508-252-3359 for Propane Plus. Three generations, you can always depend on Propane Plus for all your heating and cooling. Call them today, 401-885-4209. Three generations, they're available 24/7. For service and delivery, and they're going to serve you for a very long time. They have a great user-friendly website. You just log on at propaneplus.com, and then you type in your zip code, residential, commercial, Propane Plus, heating and cooling, always there for you. Give them a call today in Rhode Island, 401-885-4209, in Massachusetts, 508-252-3359, the Johnson family, three generations, heating and cooling. You can always depend on Propane Plus. Do you need a good plumber? I found the best plumber, JMB Plumbing. Call them today, all your plumbing needs, 401-743-9153. JMB Plumbing. They've been providing plumbing services for years. Skilled professionals stand behind their work. Guarantee you will be happy. Maybe it's repairing damaged water pipes, repair clogged pipelines, maybe replace a water heater, as well as all your plumbing needs. Call them now. It's JMB Plumbing, 401-743-9153. Nothing throws off your life or your home or your business. When you need plumbing service, you need someone reliable, someone who's professional, someone who'll handle the job and do it right. It's JMB Plumbing. Call them today, 401-743-9153, JMB Plumbing, and look for them on Facebook. When it comes to insurance, you need a neighbor, a partner, and friend. You need Choppa Insurance Agency. They're located right on Reservoir Avenue in Cranston. Call today, free consultation, 401-900-INSU, 401-900-4678, Choppa Insurance, SIA. Steven, very experienced, whether it's auto, home, renters, business insurance, flood, recreational, umbrella, any other protection for your assets, Rhode Island and Massachusetts, Choppa Insurance Agency, your agency of choice. Call today, set up a meeting. They're so knowledgeable, can have everything under one roof. Call Choppa Insurance today, 401-900-INSU or 401-900-4678. Look for them on Facebook, again, located Reservoir Avenue in Cranston. Choppa Insurance Agency, your neighbor, your partner, your friend. One-stop insurance solutions. A great meal, a great time is waiting for you at the Cohasset Inn. Rhode Island tradition since 1977, 226 Cohesit Avenue, West Warwick. They have a large dining room, perfect, maybe a group, maybe a collation, lunch. The Cohesit Inn, getting a big group together, or maybe just you alone, or a date. 226 Cohesit Avenue, West Warwick. Great staff, terrific food. They're always working on the menu. And they also have a nice lounge as well. You have the market at Cohesit right there. They're open 7 days a week. I'll see you for a great meal. Make it the Cohesit Inn. It's My Health, 1099 Mendon Road in Cumberland, diagonally across from Davenport Restaurant. Stop in and see Marie, that historic white church. Shop local, inside, all quality products, vitamins, herbal remedies, trusted companies. They understand quality, integrity. It's My Health. It's all about your health. Local products, ICE, honey, maple syrup, beef fresh gum. You know, they carry over 250 bulk herbs, teas, and spices that can be purchased by the ounce, plus box herbs and teas, hemp and CBD products, and much more natural skincare products. Stop in and see Marie at It's My Health, 1099 Mendon Road in Cumberland. It's all about health for you, for your family. There's vitamins for children, all different types of teas, all different types of spices. Boy, what a difference it'll make. Shop local. Stop in and see the Queen of Health. It's Marie at It's My Health, 1099 Mendon Road in Cumberland, diagonally across from Davenport Restaurant, right in that historic white church. It's all about health. It's all about your health at It's My Health. For all your tree needs, call Yankee Tree today. The tree trimming experts in Lincoln. Call Yankee Tree at 401-439-6028. Whether it's tree removal, stump grinding, tree pruning, emergency service, bucket truck service, even bobcat service, you can depend on Yankee Tree. Remember, 24/7 emergency service is available. They are fully insured, licensed arborists. Yankee Tree. With all these storms, don't let some dangerous branches fall onto your home or business. Call Yankee Tree today, 401-439-6028. The tree trimming experts in Lincoln, you can depend on Yankee Tree Service. Call them, 401-439-6028. Free quote, 24/7 emergency service, Yankee Tree Service. There when you need them, 401-439-6028. Meal, a great time is waiting for you at the Cohesit Inn, Rhode Island tradition since 1977, 226 Cohesit Avenue, West Warwick. They have a large dining room, perfect, maybe a group, maybe a collation, lunch. The Cohesit Inn, getting a big group together, or maybe just you alone, or a date. 226 Cohesit Avenue, West Warwick. Great staff, terrific food. They're always working on the menu. And they also have a nice lounge as well. You have the market at Cohesit right there. They're open 7 days a week. I'll see you for a great meal. Make it the Cohesit Inn.